Welcome to NPR's roundup of the week's very best arts and cultural stories. I am Netta Ulibi. You can subscribe to this podcast at npr.org/culturetopia. This week, the Nashville songwriters, song pushers, and publishers who bring songs from ideas to the radio. The thriving orchestra in Mexico's most violent city, Juarez. And the 50th anniversary of Island Records, the label that brought reggae from Jamaica to the world. But first.
These days, a pop song often begins in the recording studio. Teams of producers and composers sit together, building tracks with a performer, all for a specific album. Professional songwriters, like those who used to work in cubicles in New York's famed Brill Building, they're largely a thing of the past. Except, that is, in Nashville. In this installment of our Hitmakers series, Craig Havegerst reports that most Nashville hits begin in small rooms and offices with just some guitars or a piano.
At one end of Music Row, the ASCAP and BMI buildings stand like twin guardians of the art and business going on up and down 16th and 17th Avenues. They are the performing rights organizations that help songwriters and publishers get paid for radio, TV, and live performances of songs.
Yes, ma'am. The door's open. You're missing a bag.
In his ground floor office at BMI, Vice President for Writer-Publisher Relations Jody Williams explains why Nashville is the last bastion of a hit-making system built on the primacy of the song.
We're on this kind of college campus here on Music Row, where it's about, 10 blocks that way and 3 or 4 blocks this way. I'd say 300 songwriters a day wake up, walk into offices on this little campus at different publishing companies, and they make coffee, and they see what falls out of the air through their heads and through their pens.
Just 2 blocks away at Bug Music, a global publisher, staff songwriter Jaron Boyer works on a new melody with co-writer Lynn Wilbanks.
Stuck right here.
5 years in the business, he's still looking for his first hit song.
I wrote, 140 songs last year, and more than half was more just me playing around and just mouthing stuff, and I'm saying something, and somebody like, yeah, that's awesome, what'd you just say? And we'll write, that'd be the hook, or that'd just click everything,
Where solo writers like Harlan Howard, Chris Christopherson, and Mel Tillis once dominated the system, today's Music Row has become a haven for co-writing. These ever-shifting combinations of 2 and 3 or more writers come together through personal relationships, Music Row politics, and a collaborative effort that can get past blocks and help finish a song by quitting time. When a song is done, the writers gather around a digital recorder or a laptop and make what's called a work tape, like this one Jaron Boyer made with co-writers Ben Stennis and Thomas Red Akins, who's singing.
There's something about lighting up a Marlboro Red and that nicotine rushing to my head and the taste of Southern Comfort on my lips tells me I ain't ready to quit.
If the publishers of the various writers agree the song is worth pitching to artists, they book studio time and musicians to make a demo recording.
There's something about driving way too fast, switching gears and hammering on the gas.
And at some point between the composing and the demo, strategy kicks in.
People are always thinking about matching songs with, so-and-so.
Tom Douglas is one of the top writers in Music City. He landed his first number one hit in 1994 and has had 3 in just the past year and a half. He reads the Row Facts, a tip sheet that covers which artists are looking for new material.
As the songwriters are writing songs, in the back of our mind, there are times where we think, all right, this song would be good for
Carrie Underwood, George Strait, or in the case of I Ain't Ready to Quit, hot newcomer Jason Aldean.
How could I ever get tired of waking?
This was the first time that Boyer, Stennis, and Akins have landed a cut on a major country star's album, a career landmark. Some believe Aldean is on track to sell 1 million copies of his new CD, which would generate about $100,000 in royalties for the song. split among three writers and their publishers, that's a rather modest payday, which is why more than ever, writers and publishers are striving for radio hits, where hundreds of spins across 2,000 country stations can generate upwards of $1 million for a single song. Songwriter Natalie Hemby performs White Liar in an office at her publisher, Carnival Music. She co-wrote the song with Miranda Lambert, the artist who made it a chart-topping, award-winning single and hit video.
We wrote it in 30 minutes, and all I did was tell her, I was like, I've had this song idea forever called White Liar, and I don't know if you... And she immediately asked, it's like a light went off. Oh my gosh, like, White Liar, like, the truth comes out a little at a time. I'm like, yes! And then we sat down and we started playing, and that's a prime example of sometimes it's just good to go in cold turkey with people and see what happens.
It was Hemby's first hit song, made easier by the good fortune of landing a writing appointment directly with the artist herself. Most songs, of course, did not have a singer attached from conception. They become the responsibility of Nashville's song pluggers, like veteran Scott Paschal.
Back in the day, it was a guy with a guitar singing songs from his catalog to people, you know.
Today, it's files on a computer. One recent afternoon, Paschal and his partner Matt Lindsay queued up songs for Steve Block, an A&R consultant who's screening material for the creative director of a Nashville label.
It's beautiful. Just out of curiosity, you also have a version with Mike singing it?
We've talked to you about that. I'm with you. Why Lovers Stay.
Yeah. Read me the bridge.
Matt Lindsay says in his career, he's plugged for publishers, song catalogs, and individual songwriters, including Garth Brooks' early smash, The Dance.
We meet with record producers, A&R people, the artists themselves, the managers, the bus driver, anybody we can get the song to get it heard, because you never know who's going to get the song cut.
This system is a way of life in Nashville, but it is one that's under pressure. Shorter radio playlists and the collapse in CD sales have made lucrative hits scarcer than ever. The city's top songwriting association estimates there are only about a quarter as many staff writers on Music Row today as there were a decade ago. Lindsay has days when he worries about the future, but he also says it's never been easy.
We get turned down 9 times out of 10, but you got to have faith and you got to keep pitching those same songs over and over and over if you really believe in them. I have songs I've been pitching 20 years that I know in my heart are hit songs. If the public could just hear it, it would resonate with them and be a number one smash.
For NPR News, I'm Craig Havokhurst in Nashville.
I finally found that you get out of life with you.
And you can hear I Ain't Ready to Quit go from work tape to album cut on our music news blog, npr.org/the record.
Cole Porter knew how to write a hit song. He wrote dozens, like Night and Day.
Night and day, you are the one.
Johnny Mercer had the gift, too. He could write a hit song, and he did. Also dozens of them, like Moon River. Well, today, it could be argued that will.i.am, the founder of the mega group Black Eyed Peas, is the biggest hit maker in the world. Will.i.am's written more than a dozen top 10 singles for his group and others. This is a new song off the Black Eyed Peas' new record. It's called The Beginning. And what Will.i.am does is to think hard, really hard, about how to make a song a hit. And here's how he makes it happen.
Peaking the music is, you know, the season right now where you take, like, this is Thriller, la, 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 and just loop the la. everybody knows Thriller, right? Then you could rock the pitch. So it's like, la, 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 la. Yesterday's DJ was like, this is Thriller. That's what a record player did back in the 80s, manipulating back and forth, scratching, right? Nowadays, I could go, this is Thriller, la, 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 la. I could make new music with music, right? So I was trying to think of a new one I can do, you know? So I was like, ooh, let me flip Time of My Life.
I had the time of my life, and I never felt this way before. And I swear, this is true, and I owe it all to you.
Oh, I had the time of my life, and I never felt this way before.
So I flipped it, you know, I peaked it on the you. The crowd went nuts. But they went nuts to the dirty bit part, the beat.
Dirty bit. Dirty bit.
So it's like the conflict of like something you were familiar with that was coupled with the antithesis of what the initial was all about.
Will.i.am, you have been part of 7 Grammys. You've written more than a dozen top 10 hits. What do you think about when you put pen to paper? I mean, what do you do when you sit down to write music?
Well, first, I don't write it on paper. I get my little mic. That's why, like I said, right when I came in the studio, I was like, hey, what kind of mic? This is the kind of mic I use in the studio. And I record, I write into the machine. And if it sounds right, like say, for example, you were like, hey, let's write a song right now. I'd be like, okay, you're probably going to get your pen and paper out. And I'll get my mic out and my computer out. And then I would mumble a cadence like, say, for example, the song is called How Are We Gonna Do This? How Are We Gonna Do This? How Are We Gonna Make It Happen? How's it gonna... Oh, no. How Are We Gonna Do This? How Are We Gonna Make It Happen? How Are We Gonna Keep the Party People Clapping? How Are We Gonna Make It? How Are We Gonna Demonstrate It? Okay. How Are We Gonna Do This? How Are We Gonna Make It Happen? How Are We Gonna Get the Party People Clapping? How Are We Gonna Make It? How Are We Gonna Demonstrate It? Why don't we go ahead and go rotate it? No, I don't like that part. Let's hear it back. So I hear it back, and I know if it feels good or not because I'm hearing it rather than writing it on a piece of paper.
What's the definition of a true MC?
Someone who rocks well and put my soul at ease.
Lyrics with entertaining capabilities.
And that's a real MC. All around me, 60 degrees.
Will.i.am, you're about to produce U2's next album. You've created this incredibly, amazingly successful band. You've got Grammys and number ones and acting credits. You were Wolverine in Madagascar 2. And where do you go from here? I mean, you're just 35 years old, right? Where do you see yourself in 10 years or 20 years from now?
That's a good question because someone hit the reset button. What I mean by that is everything's changed. For example, media, traditional print, it's changed. Ain't going to be here 5 years from now. Television, it's changing. Won't be the same 5 years from now. Everything's going to change. Everything's changing. And I see that.
Do you think you're going to be a performer? Do you think you're going to be making music and performing music?
I'm going to be performing music because I love music. I'm going to be making music because I'm addicted to making music. But I'm also going to be, you know, I love animation. I want to assemble a group of animators. I want to assemble a group of code writers. I want people to write code. I want to think of concepts and write applications and programs based on my concepts. But to do that, you need code writers. So I remember a long time ago when I started the Black Eyed Peas, I was like, dude, we need to get a band. Yo, we need to find a drummer. Yeah, we need to find a guitarist, too. Yeah, get a bass player. Yeah, we need to get a guy who could write chords so we could write songs. The reason why we did that is because we wanted people to come see us and hear our music, bringing people together, right? Today's groups are code writers, but they don't just bring 20,000 people at Staples Center or the, you know, Madison Square Garden. These new groups of four cats coming together writing code bring tens and millions of people together every day. using the platform, not listening to it. And on the platform that they built, you listen to music. You listen to perspective and see opinions. It's a different group. So when I see, like, Twitter or Facebook, I see the Rolling Stones and the Beatles. It's the new groups. So 10 years from now, I could be Mr. Zuckerberg. I could be that dude, right? Some little kid that's 15 years old could be that dude 10 years from now. But the next version of it. Right? Because someone hit the reset button.
That's will.i.am. He's a frontman for the mega group Black Eyed Peas. The band's new record is called The Beginning. will.i.am, thank you so much.
Thank you so much.
I got these haters on my back. These haters on my back. Gotta get these motherfucking haters on my back. I know why they hating, good. I'm sitting on stacks. Now I'm steady chilling and I'm spinning all that. I'm a big beat.
Island Records turns 50 this year. That's the label that not only brought reggae from Jamaica to the world, but British folk rockers from the 60s and 70s, and a lot of influential pop artists. A new book, The Story of Island Records, is filled with essays and memorable album artwork. Chris Blackwell, the founder of Island Records, wrote the preface. He's been in the States for a book signing and joins us in our studios. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thank you.
And, you know, before we launch into the interview, I'm going to go to your website. 50th anniversary website called island50.com, and there's an audio player that gives gives people an idea of the astonishing range of artists.
You can get it, the heart is missing now. You can get it if you really want.
Jimmy Cliff.
You can get it if you really want.
Yeah. You know this one?
I'm trying to remember it. Oh, yes, of course, yes. Wordy Rapping Hood, isn't it?
Yep, Tom Tom Club.
That's right.
Exactly.
Tom Tom Club, Chris and Tina Franz, who were members of Talking Heads, mm-hmm. and they bought an apartment in the Bahamas where I lived and had a recording studio. And they started this band and recorded that record in the studio in Nassau.
It's all right now.
Right.
This sure became a big hit for you, didn't it?
Huge hit.
Yeah.
Huge hit.
By Free, we should explain. Well, if there's one artist from Island Records who needs no introduction, but I want you to give him one anyway.
Bob Marley.
Yeah.
I met him in 1973, and we started to work very closely together.
That's an extraordinary list. First artist you signed was?
The first artist I signed was a group called Lance Haywood. They were a jazz quartet who were playing at the hotel where I was teaching water skiing.
The Half Moon?
Half Moon, that's right. You know, I love music and I love jazz, and this was a kind of jazz combo. We recorded the record, and I was elated. I just loved the feeling of being part of music.
Let's hear a bit of the first really great hit. This is from Millie.
My boy, lollipop, you make my heart go giddy up. You are as sweet as candy. You're my sugar dandy. Welcome, my boy, lollipop.
Millie was a Jamaican girl. She was only 15 when we recorded this. And people really liked the Jamaican records. They sounded very different. They sounded very odd. And people really liked it, but they loved Millie.
What made you decide to have Island branch out from reggae?
It happened basically after Millie. Mm-hmm. Because suddenly, you know, from obscurity, I was now, you know, a producer and manager of a hit artist. And when that happens, you know, people call you. And somebody called me and said, you know, you should go to Birmingham and see some bands, because there are a lot of bands in Birmingham. So I went up there, and they took me to a club, and this club was like on about the third floor. And walking up the stairs, I heard this voice, which sounded just unbelievable, you know, and this pounding kind of blues music. I went in, and again, he was 15 at the time, Steve Winwood, and I talked with them and signed them right away.
Well, my time with God,
nobody had ever seen or heard anybody quite like him in England, because he was a multi-instrumentalist. He was a brilliant guitar player, a keyboard player, especially Hammond organ, and had an amazing voice. And so when I signed him, other rock acts then started to come to Ireland.
You heard about an Irish band playing at a pub in London?
Yes. I walked in. I didn't love the music that much, quite honestly, because it was a little rinky-dink to me, because I love bass and drum. But I loved them. There was a passion. There was something about them I really, really admired.
We should explain, we're talking about you too.
You too, that's it.
So you didn't like the music necessarily, but you liked them.
I believed in them.
I bet you like what they've done for you.
Oh, I sure do. Of course they do.
What do you hear that maybe other people miss? What makes a hit?
Well, frankly, we didn't have that many hits. We've had a lot of great artists. But if you look at Motown and you look at Ireland, Motown probably had 50 times as many single hits as we did. So I was never really a record guy in that kind of a sense. I think my area is more artist development. And to me, the records are the milestones in the artist's career. You don't want to have a hit and have somebody destroyed, you know, because of the hit. I think if you can go slowly, just let it grow gently. And I'd say to people, if you love what you're doing, what's the hurry?
Yeah. You know, since it is the 50th birthday of Island Records, and we're sitting here with you, Mr. Blackwell, you're the one that we want to ask, what music would you like to go out on?
Well, I'd like to go out on one of my favorite songs. It's a Bob Marley song. It's called So Much Trouble in the World. I love that song.
Well, I think we can promise. Here it is. Chris Blackwell, the founder of Island Records. Mr. Blackwell, thanks so much.
Thank you.
More of our conversation with Chris Blackwell is at our website, nprmusic.org.
In 1968, Simon & Garfunkel recorded the bittersweet song, America. It's about a man who leaves Saginaw, Michigan to find the true meaning of America. Rumor has it, Paul Simon wrote that song in Saginaw. Well, this past week, a reporter at the Saginaw News noticed lyrics from that song artfully spray-painted on abandoned buildings all over town. And it didn't seem random, but more like a guerrilla-type art project. And so, after some digging, we managed to track down one of the people behind it, and here's a story.
I think if Paul Simon came back to Saginaw, he'd just be shocked. I mean, it once was an incredibly thriving, booming, bustling city. I think that after the census comes in, I don't know if it'll even be classified as a city anymore. It's gotten pretty small. My name is Eric Schantz. I am a mural painter in Saginaw, Michigan. We have a city that has basically been abandoned after the post-industrial decline. General Motors closed their factories and left and kind of left our city to decay. A few years ago, me and my friends, we decided to go around the city and start painting the boarded up buildings and storefronts.
It took me 4 days to hitchhike from Saginaw. To look for America.
America has become a homesick song for Saginawians. The city once was vastly populated, a couple hundred thousand, and now it's below 50,000. People left to go find their America, to pursue their American dream. And when they left, they never really came back.
Toss me a cigarette, I think there's one in my raincoat.
I graduated and went off to college, pretty convinced that Saginaw had nothing to offer me as an artist. went to Kansas City, made some good money, but when I was in school, I really did miss my town. As much as I didn't really like it at the time, it's still home. It's still your hometown.
And the moon rose over an open field.
I used to sit in my dorm room at least once a week and play America, just because that line, leaving Saginaw to go look for America, and I was just like, well, this is what I'm doing. I wasn't planning on coming back, and fate landed me back here, and I figured that, well, I'm here for a reason, and I'll find my purpose, and I think that's become making public art. I really want to inspire people to start taking ownership in the city's problems, because the city really can't afford to fix them.
Counting the cars on the New Jersey Turnpike, they've all come to look for America.
It's not going to come back. It's not going to be the Saginaw it was. It will be a new Saginaw. It's not going to be the big industrial mecca that it was. It's not going to have 250,000 people living here. It's just going to be a really nice, small town. I just really think that we can, as citizens, make this into the town that we want it to be.
That's the voice of Eric Shantz. He's a member of Paint Saginaw, a public art collective in Saginaw, Michigan. You can see a few photographs of their America project at our website, npr.org.
It has been a rough couple of years in Juarez, the murder capital of Mexico. Drug violence and organized crime are rampant. An estimated quarter of the population has fled, and thousands of businesses have closed. This year, for the first time, the city even canceled its Independence Day celebration. But as NPR's John Burnett reports, the Juarez Symphony Orchestra plays on.
Tuba player Steve Haddad stands backstage in his tux with some of the other brass players in the Juarez Symphony Orchestra.
We are members of the world's most dangerous orchestra, because Juarez is the world's most dangerous city. That immediately makes us members of the world's most dangerous orchestra.
You just gave me my lead. The Symphony Orchestra of the Autonomous University of the City of Juarez was founded 5 years ago. Then the cartel war broke out, and the city began its descent into lawlessness. But the Juarez Symphony is thriving in spite of the city's 12-a-day homicide rate. Here they produce more operas than any other Mexican city outside of the capital. They're presenting 5 operas this year, including La Bohème and The Marriage of Figaro, along with 5 orchestra concerts. How do they do it in a city so inured to violence that headless corpses have become passé and school children practice diving for cover? The dynamo behind the ambitious music program is the 42-year-old conductor, Maestro Carlos Garcia Ruiz. A native Chihuahuan, Garcia studied in Vienna. He's guest conducted orchestras around the world, and he serves as director of the university's burgeoning music program.
When the violence was really increasing, the economy was going down, also we started to making more concerts, more operas, and that's why, in the same time that the things really is going bad, also we can have a good artistic health.
This is not to say the Juarez Symphony is immune to the violence. Most of its well-heeled local patrons have fled to El Paso, and many professional musicians who live in the U.S. and play for the El Paso and Las Cruces symphonies refuse to come to Juarez anymore. Their seats were filled with student musicians. With the city's crime epidemic, orchestra members have been robbed, carjacked, and extorted.
I've received calls trying to extort me, but I didn't pay.
Momchil Gozdov is the principal cellist and a native of Bulgaria. 4 Bulgarians play in the Juarez Symphony. They say they love Mexico and this orchestra in particular.
It's a light in the darkness.
The Juarenses are accustomed to locking themselves in their homes after dark. Music lovers still come out at night. A chef named Rosa Maria Olivas says she wouldn't miss a concert.
Significa enriquecimiento para el alma y el espíritu.
The orchestra represents enrichment for the soul and the spirit, a moment of peace, a moment of enjoyment in this madness we're living.
One El Paso musician who still has the cojones to play in the world's most dangerous orchestra is trombonist Steve Wilson. He says it's the audiences in Juarez that keep him coming over.
There's been times when we've played 2-3 encores after a concert, and they'll just keep clapping until basically make us play another piece.
This was the case last month when the symphony played a program of music by Mexican composers to commemorate the Mexican Revolution. After the orchestra finished the crowd favorite, Jesusita in Chihuahua, the audience gave them such a long encore, they had to play it again. As the ebullient crowd leaves the theater, tuba player Steve Haddad steps down from the riser and smiles with satisfaction.
You see what we're talking about as far as the appreciative audience. People looking for a refuge anywhere they can, and this may be one for the wonderful citizens of Juarez.
There are even bigger plans for 2011, believing that music has the power not just to revitalize listeners, but to rescue a life. There's a plan to take classical music into the most marginalized neighborhoods of Juarez. Maestro Garcia has been selected by the Federal Council for Culture and Arts to create 10 youth music ensembles in the toughest barrios, where rootless young men become teenaged assassins. Then once a week, all 200 young musicians from across the city will gather in the concert hall to play as the Juarez Youth Orchestra. Again, Carlos Garcia.
We say, el que tiene un instrumento en sus manos en la tarde, en la noche, no va a agarrar un arma en sus manos.
Translation, he who has an instrument in his hands in the afternoon won't pick up a weapon at night. John Burnett, NPR News.
And you can hear a performance by the Juarez Symphony Orchestra at nprmusic.org.
That's it for this week. You can find links to all the stories we have today and subscribe to NPR's Arts Channel at npr.org/culturetopia. I am Netta Ulibi. Thanks for listening to Culturetopia. So long.